Welcome to the lecture this evening. My name is Arne Westad. I'm one of two directors of the Cold War Studies Center here at LSE with my very good friend, Professor Mick Cox, sitting down there. I should thank Mick for being instrumental in organizing tonight's event and inviting our speaker. We are extremely lucky tonight to have with us Dr. Andrei Grachev, who was born in Moscow in 1941. He graduated in history, I'm happy to say, from the Moscow Institute of International Relations. He was the editor of World Youth, the magazine for the World Youth Movement in Budapest, Hungary. He became the deputy director of the International Department of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union and a key advisor for President Mikhail Gorbachev. He was later appointed the official spokesman of the president of the USSR until Gorbachev's resignation in December 1991. After leaving office, Dr. Grachev has worked on a number of publications. He has published a volume of memoirs and a number of other books, and he presently divides his time between Paris and Moscow. Before turning over to tonight's speaker, I just wanted to read to you, as introduction, an excerpt from Mr. Grachev's memoirs, which I think are among the most interesting memoirs that came out of the collapse of the Soviet Union in terms of really understanding what happened on the inside. There are very few people, if any, who were as close to President Gorbachev as Mr. Grachev was in the final days of the Soviet Union. And this is what he writes in his memoirs about President Gorbachev's very last day in office. On December 25th, this is 1991, the president arrived at the Kremlin later than usual and closeted himself in his office. His anteroom was strangely empty. Not a single visitor was present. All the receptionists had come in at the same time to sort out the books Gorbachev was taking with him and discard papers that were no longer needed. I showed him, Gorbachev, the front page of Moskovsky Komsomolets, whose headline was a quotation from Pushkin. Russian speakers here will know this. "No, I shall not die completely," it said. "My soul, by the lyre, will survive and escape corruption," Gorbachev completed without emphasis, smiling. Later on in the studio, the television studio where the actual resignation took place, which was known in the Kremlin as room number one, Gorbachev entered the room at 7:05, and greeting people he knew as he passed, he made his way with some difficulty to the brightly lit table where a microphone awaited him. He was carrying a briefcase containing his speech and the decree enacting his resignation from the post of Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces. Gorbachev placed the decree in front of him and then asked suddenly, "When should I sign it? Before or after my statement?" He was speaking to Yakovlev and me, this is Grachev speaking, who were trying to manage all this chaos. Our opinions differed, and we each had our own set of reasons for one or the other approach. While we argued, Gorbachev asked me for a pen and tested it on a sheet of paper. "I prefer a smoother writing one," he said. The head of the CNN crew, who was present at the taping, reached over my shoulder to offer his pen. Gorbachev, satisfied with the instrument and paying no further attention to our discussion, placed the decree of resignation in front of him, signed it with a flourish, and set it aside. Two very ordinarily looking men in civilian clothes were sitting in the president's anteroom with an instrument that looked like a cellular phone. These two colonels, who accompanied the president wherever he went, were in fact the button, or rather one of the elements in a complex network equipped to control the launch of nuclear devices. These people then appeared suddenly and disappeared into the corridors in search of the new boss. We are very pleased to have Mr. Andrei Grachev with us for tonight's lecture. We are all looking forward to listen to what you have to say. Please.
Thank you very much for this introduction, and I can tell you that since those lines were written quite a number of years ago, I suddenly felt moved. You forced me to go back in that history. I'll force you to go with me in that history with the subject that you have proposed, and I would like to thanking you for this possibility to speak at this very honorary podium to congratulate you on the selection of the date. I don't know, deliberate or not, but it is 17 years ago precisely that the Berlin Wall fell, and 1 month and a half from now it will be 15 years exactly from the 25th of December, the collapse and the breakup of the Soviet Union and resignation of Gorbachev. And these two dates are in direct relation to our subject, because though you suggested as a title the collapse of Soviet Empire, in fact one needs two dates, because they were two empires. One, the external one, the outside zone of influence, which stretched far beyond the Yalta zone of influence attributed to the Soviet Union in 1945. And the second was the Soviet Union, the historical Russian and Soviet Empire. But if in fact the Soviet Union was carrying a number of characteristics typical for an empire, be it Austro-Hungarian or Ottoman or a colonial one like British or French, it certainly was a special kind of an empire. Well, as many of you remember, Lev Tolstoy in Anna Karenina, he starts actually Anna Karenina by a phrase, "All happy families are alike, all unhappy families are different." Well, since you can hardly qualify an empire a happy family, that means that all empires are special. And maybe the Soviet one was more special than the others. It was ideological, it was evil, and at the same time it was a one country which broke to pieces in 1991. Well, I would like to start precisely with the term collapse. With the years that have passed, we have many, maybe even too many, explanations of why did it happen. Well, there are people and books that explain it by the kind of a natural law of empires that could not survive in the 20th century. There are those, especially in the US, who pretend that the collapse of the Soviet Empire came as a result of the West's resolution and determination, and particularly under the pressure of the SDI, very hypothetical and very improbable project of Ronald Reagan. The SDI, meaning, I have always remind myself that I am addressing an audience that happily lives with a quite different vocabulary than we in our years. Well, alongside the Americans, there were others who were claiming their, at least part, of action in provoking the collapse of the Soviet Empire, the Poles would say that it was the Pope and Solidarność. The Muslims would say that it was the defeat of the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And there you would find a lot, especially inside the former Soviet Union, who would say that the real reason of the collapse of the Soviet Empire was vodka, meaning the anti-alcoholic campaign carelessly launched by Gorbachev. Yes, or imprudently. Well, you should be indulgent with my with my English. Well, yet even if even taken together, all these reasons do not answer the following questions: why should this collapse occur at that time, and why should it take such a mild form of a kind of a civilized divorce, avoiding or sparing for the former Soviet Union the nightmare of a Yugoslavia and the civil war? Also, why should the collapse of such a powerful empire, after all, the Second World superpower, should start from Moscow, from the heart of the system and the state, and even more directly from the Kremlin, which contrasts greatly, by the way, a number of other prophecies that have been formulated, like, for example, the one given by Hélène Carrère-Dancos, a well-known Soviet expert in France, who was announcing that the collapse of the empire would come in the form of the uprising of the Central Asian republics. One of the great paradoxes of Gorbachev's historic balance sheet, from my point of view, has become the fact that at least regarding the collapse of the Soviet Union, this historic result of his action did not coincide with his initial project. Until now, by the way, Gorbachev, if you talk to him, would refuse to take the praise for what happened to the Soviet Union, insisting that it could have been secured. And the explanation of this paradox for me is a rather simple fact. Naturally, Gorbachev, as any other politician, could change his immediate political goals. But throughout his political action and stay in power, he never diverted from his main course, principles, and goal: the democratization of the Soviet society and its reconciliation and reunion of his country with the rest of the world. And this fidelity to certain moral principles was applied particularly in two very important cases. First, with regard to his initial project, the project of Perestroika, which consisted in an attempt to rejuvenile, to galvanize, and after all, to save the Russian or Russia's socialist project, launched in 1917 by the revolution, trying to separate the project from Stalinism, going very much in the tradition of a whole generation of Soviet шестидесятниц, we call it in Russian, the generation of the 60s. That means, in other words, the children of the 20th Congress and the beginning of the de-Stalinization launched by Khrushchev. And second, after Gorbachev realized that the system of revitalization of this model was no more possible, he tried to save the federal state, the Union state, by a project of its reform, even at the price of sacrificing the former political system, trying to transform the Soviet Union into a federation or even a confederation, inspired by the example of the European Union. Yet in both cases, he had to discover that since without the use of force and coercion, that was not possible, he made a choice in favor of fidelity to the bigger project, that of democratic reform. The two empires to which I referred right now had one common means, a kind of a tie, and even I would call it a staple that was bounding them, force. But there were specific means to keep together the different sets of states and territories. For the countries of the Warsaw Pact, mainly the Eastern European ones, it was not only the force, that means the stick, but also the carrot, the Comecon organization, the Council of Economic Assistance, providing cheap oil and gas and other Soviet resources. That was transforming this Soviet empire, again, in a very specific one, in an empire where metropoli was living poorer than its clients. In the Soviet Union itself, I mean the inner empire, again, the force was, after all, the dominant feature of the system. But apart from the coercion of the totalitarian regime, there were also other elements, like bureaucracy. In Soviet times, it was called nomenklatura, but it was largely inherited from the imperial Russian state. And, strangely enough, for the biggest state in the world, the threat of the internal aggression, invasion, the external threat. Gorbachev's political reform gradually and one after another brought about the elimination of all of these staples. Having proclaimed the freedom of choice in his 1988 speech in the United Nations, he buried the Brezhnev Doctrine. And the force was the element of keeping the external empire. He dismantled the party's power monopoly that was used also by the other regimes in East European countries as a way of rule over the society. Starting a new détente with the West, and particularly with the United States, which produced a new climate in the East-West relations, he destroyed the spirit of the besieged fortress that served from Stalin to Brezhnev times throughout the Cold War as an efficient means to suppress internal dissent and to justify, to serve as an alibi for the daily misery of millions of Soviet households. Maybe at first, as a convinced internationalist and a model Soviet citizen, Gorbachev could not imagine that in a multinational country, his radical divorce with Stalinism and democratization of political life would not only logically open the way for various national separatist and autonomous movements, but that most of the social, political, and economic conflicts and contradictions inside this huge society and reality that was the Soviet Union would dress in national costumes. Going back to the chronicle, Gorbachev himself set fire to the powder in the Soviet Empire in December 1986 when he tried to replace a powerful leader of the Kazakh Republic, Mr. Kunaev, by his nominee of Russian origin. Kunaev was a veteran of Brezhnev Guard. Behind the violent streets manifestations that were provoked by this nomination and the first casualties of perestroika were not so much the hurt feelings of the young people who went down the streets, but the mafia interests, the feudal privileges of the local party bosses, which repeated sometime later in Uzbekistan and in Azerbaijan, where inter-ethnic riots were artfully provoked. Next came the challenge of the central to the central power coming from the proletarians of the Soviet Empire, the Crimean Tatars, who, as other people who had been suppressed and deported by Stalin and not completely rehabilitated by Khrushchev, had nothing to lose, starting with their homes and territory. They staged their manifestations in the center of Moscow, on the Red Square, and in this square facing the building of the Central Committee, challenging Gorbachev and forcing him to a choice, either to suppress them by force or go ahead from the point at which Khrushchev stopped. Further on, Gorbachev had to go further from the point not only where Khrushchev stopped, but where he retreated in Budapest in 56. In 1988 came the time of the old-time inter-ethnic conflicts in the Caucasus. Rudely suppressed by the Soviet regimes, the Armenian-Azeri conflict in over the Karabakh that produced violent pogroms in Sumgait. And then April 1989 in Tbilisi, where local nationalists, headed by Gamsa Khurdia, demanded simultaneously the autonomy for Georgia from the central state and at the same time the suppression of autonomy for Abkhazia, which is a region of autonomous region of ethnic minority within Georgia. This manifestation provoked clashes with the army and police, and again, new victims. Next year, Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan, where the National Front with the former Politburo member, Gaidar Aliyev, commanding these troops behind the scenes, tried to storm the local party and government headquarters. Had it happened now, the Western press would have qualified it as another colored revolution. This time, Gorbachev declared the state of siege and sent the troops to avoid new anti-Russian and anti-Armenian pogroms. But the clash with the army produced more than 100 victims. If after his speech in the United Nations, December 1988, and immediately following the dramatic events in Tbilisi, speaking inside the session of Politburo, Gorbachev said that he was determined to avoid by all means the use of force while handling the internal evolution and the reform inside the Soviet Union. He said, I quote more or less, "Once we suggest to renounce the use of force in international relations, how can we resort to it inside our country?" After Baku, he wrote in his memoirs that he recognized in extreme situations for political authority the necessity to use force to protect civilian population. But the great paradox of his December 1988 speech in the General Assembly of the United Nations, where he formulated his foreign policy doctrine, the new political thinking offered to the world, where he announced the not only the burial of the Brezhnev doctrine, but the freedom of choice, and the withdrawal of almost 500,000 of Soviet troops from the Eastern Europe, that though this speech was directed mostly to the West, it was above all heard, first of all, in the East, in the Eastern Europe, especially since the announcement of the withdrawal of Soviet troops from these countries was meaning much more than just another solemn political statement. And it was this speech that, starting with the spring of 1989, provoked the landslide of Velvet Revolutions in the Eastern Europe and the beginning of the end of the first external empire presided by the Soviet Union. In fact, Gorbachev's new political thinking and the action of his government eliminated the two basic elements that were present in keeping the outside empire of the stick, the elimination of Brezhnev doctrine, and of the carrot, because soon after that the Comecon was dissolved. And Gorbachev and his government announced to the East European allies of the Soviet Union that the time of cheap credits and cheap oil and gas was over. One of the assistants and advisors of Gorbachev, his advisor for economic affairs, Nikolai Petrakov, told me that, according to him, the Soviet Union has lost the Third World War once it started to prepare for it seriously, investing almost 60%, if not more, of its national product in the various sectors of defense, economy, science, technology. Yet by mid-80s, it was obvious, not only for Gorbachev, but the entire political leadership in the Soviet Union, that the USSR could neither extend the sphere of its influence with the fiasco of invasion of Afghanistan, nor keep under control what it already possessed, like in Poland. Those were the two examples, one the invasion, the other the non-invasion, that signaled the beginning of the decline of that empire. Gorbachev, already in 1986, in a secret meeting with the leaders of socialist countries, warned them about his intention to evacuate Afghanistan, but also to change the nature of relations between Moscow and its allies in the Eastern Europe. In fact, he warned them in advance, meaning or intending to give them time to prepare for the changes he was planning to introduce inside the Soviet system and inside the Soviet Union. He also announced to them that from that time on they should not count on Soviet armies to keep those regimes in power. At that time, most of the East European leaders just couldn't believe him. And one could understand them, because some of them were thinking that, that's another statement coming from a Soviet leader. Khrushchev, after all, in 1956, he was producing the kind of statements which was no worse than this one. And then came 1956 and Budapest. Or, in case he tries to implement this policy and reform, he wouldn't be allowed to do it. And maybe several months after Gorbachev, they would have to confirm their fidelity to another Soviet leader, like Ligachev, for example. Yet in 1989 came the season of a change provoked, first of all, by the transformation that took place already inside the Soviet Union. And the 89 season of velvet revolutions in Eastern Europe, but already in the Baltic states, that means inside the USSR, came as a reaction to the new political thinking philosophy formulated by Gorbachev in 1988. The chronology of this year repeated the one of 1956. First started the Poles, bringing to power the anti-communist government of Solidarność with a prime minister serving under a communist president, Jaruzelski. And Gorbachev not only didn't interfere, Jaruzelski told me that prior to the elections that he knew the communists would be losing, he went to Moscow and discussed the situation with Gorbachev and got a green light for him, an encouragement. Next were the Hungarians, opening the border with Austria and then letting the first thousands of the Eastern Germans to cross the border of the Warsaw Pact, preferring this section of the border to the Berlin Wall at that time. Differently from Khrushchev, Gorbachev didn't use force to keep the empire. The Baltic states represented a much harder case for him because they were part of the Soviet Union. And their claim for independence were coming at a moment which already, from the point of view of internal political tension, was extremely difficult for him. They were dangerously exposing Gorbachev in his confrontation with the conservative opposition in Moscow. And he tried his best to persuade the Balts to wait until the calendar of the perestroika would help resolve the problem of their search of autonomy. At that time, the claims were autonomy. But the Balts didn't want to wait. They didn't want to follow Gorbachev's timetable. And also, they didn't want to follow George Bush's and Mitterrand and Kohl's advice, because all these Western leaders, fearing the difficulties and maybe the activation of the resistance of conservative forces against Gorbachev in Moscow, were trying to contain Landsbergis, the leader of the Lithuanian parliament and of the National Front. But the Balts were following their own logic, precisely because they too were fearing this kind of revolt of the conservatives in the back of Gorbachev. Gorbachev for them was their window of possibility. And this, they didn't know if it wouldn't shut abruptly. In fact, the Balts were wise enough to apprehend the putsch of the conservatives against Gorbachev, except that they believed that it could come earlier than August 91. And yet the fatal role for the fate of the Union state was played not by any of the national republics of the Soviet Union, but by the Russian Federation itself and its leaders. Gorbachev's adversaries of different orientation, from conservatives like Ligachev, the leader of Russian conservative communist wing of the party, to radical Democrats headed at that time by Boris Yeltsin, though diametrically opposite in their own relations and irreconcilable, played jointly against him the Russian card. The former, the conservatives, trying to force him to resort to force in order to secure the unitary state, but de facto to force him to renounce his project of democratization of the system. The latter, the radical Democrats, they didn't conceal their intention to destroy the Union state with the purpose to chase Gorbachev from the Kremlin. At that time, Boris Yeltsin, I'm tempted always to say a paradox, but there are no paradoxes in history. It's a logic, political logic. So Boris Yeltsin, an outspoken anti-communist, was resorting to the tactics of Vladimir Lenin, who at the time when he was mobilizing his political army against the Tsarist regime in the center of Imperial Russia, was gathering the troops of on the periphery of the Russian Empire. And his slogan, addressed not only to republics, but even to the regions of Russia, "Take as much sovereignty as you can digest." As well as the decision of the Russian parliament to confirm the superiority of the Russian laws, republican laws, against those of the federal state, provoked what was called at that time in the Soviet Union the parade of sovereignties. Already in the autumn of 1990, Boris Yeltsin was threatening Gorbachev that Russia might leave the Soviet Union if he doesn't accept his conditions of the political alliance. Other republics and regions, sometimes it went even to the regions of Moscow, followed the example. Moldavia, one of the Soviet republics, voted its joining of Romania. Well, I mentioned already that the Armenian parliament and the Karabakh parliament, the Karabakh is an enclave, what's the English for it? Inside Azerbaijan, voted their reunion. Kazakhstan declared the closure of the testing ground for nuclear weapons in Semipalatinsk, and also claimed for itself Baikonur, the launching site for the Soviet space ships and missiles. And the Russian government formally announced its intention to restore the Kuril Islands to Japan. You can imagine a mess it was providing in the country. Under this joint pressure of Republican national elites, Gorbachev was trying to maneuver. He staged a referendum in March 1991 and got the approval of more than 70% of the Russian population, that of the Soviet population, I'm sorry. Not all the republics were participating in the vote, but in those that participated, over 70% voted in favor of keeping the Union state. Among those republics was Ukraine. Gorbachev, in his turn, resorted to Lenin's tactics. But this time it was a different Lenin, not the Lenin that was fighting the Tsarist Empire, but the Lenin in power. And this time Gorbachev borrowed Lenin's tactics of the Brest Peace Treaty, the treaty that Lenin accepted to sign with the Germans at the time of the desperate defeat of the Russian revolutionaries, that was sacrificing an important part of Russian territory to the Germans, expecting that in the long run, and this this hope of Lenin was after all justified, Russia would rebuild its territory. So Gorbachev's Brest Treaty took the form of a new Union Treaty that he convinced the leaders of 9 republics out of 15, at least 9 republics out of 15, but who promised and accepted to sign the new Union Treaty that was transforming the former rigid, centralized and militarized state into a flexible, soft union of Gorbachev. He suggested a confederal state, a confederation, though happily the Russian language, being quite a flexible one, suggests that an evasive term, a union, could mean at the same time a union, a federal union, and a confederative state. But de facto, the formula that was suggested by Gorbachev to keep the relations between the former republics of the Soviet Union, the republics of the Soviet Union at that time, was the confederation. He even declared, ready to satisfy the appetites of the Russian Republican elite, that he would be ready not to present himself as candidate for the next president's election, de facto offering to Boris Yeltsin the place of the president of the new Union state. But it was him and his perestroika project that were the targets. Gorbachev's dream was a union inspired by the example of the European Union community at that time. I had the chance to assist at his last official meeting with French President François Mitterrand in November of 1991, several weeks before his resignation, and the two were speculating about an eventual perspective of the future Europe that would be posed on two pyres, you can say it. The West, integrated according to the logic of the European integration engaged by the Treaty of Rome, and the East, with the reformed Soviet Union and with the Eastern Europe that would accept the new formulas of association. And these two supports of the new Europe, these two lungs, borrowing the expression of Jean-Paul II, could be the real foundation of the new Europe. But during this conversation, Mitterrand had reason to tell him that we have already our Western pyre. It's up to you to take care of yours. Well, it wasn't possible due to the logic that had acquired already the process of disintegration, internal disintegration of the Soviet state, but also the explosion of the internal contradictions of the various political poles inside the Russian society. By the way, in July, at the time when the new Union Treaty was drafted, Yeltsin accepted to sign it. And this is maybe an element of the answer to a question that I mentioned at the beginning of my lecture. Was Gorbachev's dream possible? You would never know, because it was aborted by two putsches, by two coups, one in August 91, followed immediately by a series of statements of independence declared by the parliaments and governments of practically all the former Soviet republics. Some of them were in a hurry to declare their independence because having observed the putsch and the tanks in Moscow on the Red Square, they apprehended the comeback to the USSR, the return of the Soviet Empire. Some, to the contrary, having observed the triumph of the Russia's radical Democrats, were apprehending the difficult relationship with the new Russian leaders and new Russia headed by Boris Yeltsin, more assertive, more authoritarian, and for this reason, non-acceptable for many. A curious paradox. General Dudaev, a leader of Chechen resistance, who at that time in August 91 was just a leader of political forces in opposition, political opposition in Chechnya, formally said that he felt happy to stay inside the soft union of Gorbachev. But after the fiasco of the coup in Moscow and the takeover of the affairs of the Russian Federation by Yeltsin and his team, in November 91, the first clash between the Chechen separatists, Chechen autonomous government, and the Russian state started, and practically the first Chechen war should be dated by the fall of 19, the beginning of it should be dated, traced to the fall of 1991. The second putsch, the second coup that took place several months after August 91, just formalized, confirmed the already existing reality. Having dismantled the elements of the previous Union state, the repression apparatus with the army and the KGB, with the party bureaucracy, and certainly with the outside fear that was partly based on reality and real confrontation between the Soviet Union and the West, partly instrumentalized and imagined by the Soviet leaders, Gorbachev didn't have means to keep this state together, having not actually the possibility, received the possibility, to use his chance to cover an abyss between the former state and the future dreamed state in one leap. When he was later accused of not sending a special commando to arrest the plotters in Belarus, just the three leaders of three republics who announced the dissolution of the Soviet state and forcing in this way Gorbachev for resignation, he said that he would never accept this because this decision, or this formula of the dissolution of the Union State was ratified by the Republican Parliament. And Gorbachev told me who had invested so much in creating the parliaments, the parliamentarian culture, and this new reality in the political system of the former Soviet Union, how would I destroy it by my own hands? He resigned, as you reminded us, on the 25th of December. And in fact, it's him, despite the fact that he certainly refuses the compliment, who should be qualified, maybe praised, maybe blamed, it depends on the choice, as the real destroyer of this double empire, just for one reason, the man who refused to be an emperor. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andrei, for a truly fascinating lecture. There is something about the development of history when it's seen by an insider which brings up all kinds of questions beyond the more general historical analysis that some of us historians are very fond of. So I wanted to start by asking a rather personal question in terms of your views of Mikhail Gorbachev. How important was his Russianness to him through all of this process? I remember in 1990, when I first met Gorbachev, some of the issues that came up was very much about his representing all of the former Soviet Union. But obviously he was a Russian. He stood in a Russian cultural tradition, and he stood in a very distinct Russian political tradition through the Communist Party that he represented. When this process was going on, those very last crucial years and months of his time in power, what role do you think that played to him, that he himself came out of that Russian origin while representing a multinational empire, as you put it?
Well, to start with, he was Russian, but not only Russian. He was also Ukrainian, half Russian, half That's Ukrainian. True. Maybe this was facilitating to him his other, I would say, and maybe main identity, which I would think he would claim even now. He considered himself to be Soviet. I give you an example that should more or less answer your question, at least partly. When he selected, when he chose Shevardnadze to be his Minister of Foreign Affairs to replace Gromyko, who, by the way, was a Belarusian. This is just to give you the idea, you know, that the element of Russianness was very much dissipated by this new notion of Soviet nation that was the formula at that time. So when he called Shevardnadze, and for Shevardnadze it was certainly a big surprise. He was never known to be an expert in international relations, and the first argument, to express his doubt that he sorted to Gorbachev was, but I'm a Georgian. Well, you should also remember there was another Georgian who was at the head of the Soviet state for a long time, 30 years. And you know what was Gorbachev's answer? He said, well, what you are saying, you are a Soviet man. So I would say that for Gorbachev, his Russianness, well, he was certainly a patriot. He was as much a Cossack, that means a person very much associated with this particular region in Russia, southern Russia, the Northern Caucasus. But it was this knowledge of this region, which borders
the Muslim areas, Chechnya in particular, that made him extremely cautious on the one hand, but on other occasions, when the whole volcano of the Caucasus, political volcano, was starting to open, largely provoked by this Armenian initiative to put on the table the Karabakh question. When Yakovlev, his closest ally and advisor, brought to the Kremlin the representatives of the Armenian diaspora. Mm. I remember Gorbachev telling them, "You are mad to propose the reconsideration of borders in the Caucasus. Mm. It's going to be blood."
Mm. Let's take a few more questions. Let's start up there. Yes, the lady turned from the back. And speak into the microphone, if you could, please.
Hello, my name is... Can you hear?
Yep.
Alexandra Yanovska, Department of Management. I have a question about how would you evaluate the real danger of going back to a military or to a real Soviet type of regime? Because you mentioned how other republics were afraid of it and how they saw it as a window of opportunity, Gorbachev's reform politics. But as an insider, I mean, this is exactly what you can say as that we might not be able to read somewhere else. What was the serious danger and how strong were the forces behind the conservatives? Thanks.
I'll take just one more question before we... Yes, on the other side of that.
What about relations with... Cuba and Castro, what was Gorbachev's views on that?
All right, Andrei.
Okay. I answer these two, yes?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the danger of real return to the USSR. Again, I think it's better to, you know, in my capacity of the insider, the living relic.
We didn't say that.
to produce the, I mean, this some citations, the opinion of the others. Well, already from a point of view of many intelligent people and wise observers of the Russian scene, it was already no more possible. It would mean an insanity, and it would never produce the result. Gorbachev, when Yakovlev, with some pieces of information that leaked from the, structures that were already engaged in the preparation of the coup, warned him about a possible action against him, a preparation of the coup. Gorbachev replied to him, but no, it's a stupidity. They are certainly very average people, but they're not stupid, because that goes nowhere, this plan. Another example of the opinion of another man, I think he was a speaker in this... and this whole Jack Matlock, he himself, he too got this kind of information, and as an obedient civil servant, he certainly communicated it to his president, to George Bush, adding his comment that here is the information I've received from Moscow Mayor Gavril Popov, but I cannot take it seriously, because I think that a project of this kind would lead nowhere. Well, until now, the organizers of this plot against Gorbachev claim that had they been harsh enough, determined enough, I personally spoke to one of the plotters, the one who was not among the formal team of the putschists, as we call them, but who was a bit behind the scene, the former chairman of the Supreme Soviet, Lukyanov. And I remember him commenting the situation. He said, well, it's not in this way that you are preparing a real coup. Meaning that the people who staged it didn't have any determination of the type of Pinochet, or why not, Deng Xiaoping in Tiananmen. So, well, the result proved what was the reality, that the society not only did not follow the putschist, but offered a serious resistance to it. And together, the human kind of belt of several thousand people that were protecting the White House and the action of Yeltsin at that time played the decisive role that that forced the plotters to renounce. But curiously enough, it was in the night when the storm was supposed to take place, and when the order to fire into the crowd was to be given, that the deputies to the plotters, the first deputies of the KGB, of the army, and of the interior, having made the circle of Moscow in night and having realized that it's going to be a bloodbath, they returned to their bosses saying, we are not going with it. And this means that perestroika has transformed also these people. Well, as to Cuba and Castro, well, Gorbachev always felt and never concealed it, a big personal respect for Castro. And he praised his action, especially in the initial stage of revolution and the whole history of relationship between Cuba and the Soviet Union. And he was feeling Castro's hesitation to follow him with his project of perestroika, because certainly it was, if, let's say, proposed as a model for other socialist countries, would be meaning, at least for many of them, the collapse of their regimes. This was, by the way, the reason why Gorbachev, having renounced the Brezhnev Doctrine, wouldn't wish to introduce, let's say, the Brezhnev Doctrine à l'envers. Mm-hmm. Upside
reverse,
down.
In reverse. Yeah.
Yeah, in reverse. Imposing on his allies, his men, who would be democratic, progressive, reform-minded, and so on. He wanted these countries to follow their own timetable and their own path of the evolution. And when he went to see Castro in 1989, I think, yes, it was 1989, before coming to Britain, in spring, I think, he tried to explain to him the philosophy of the new political thinking and his conception of freedom of choice, and finally both agreed on the formula that certainly may be considered as tricky. But Gorbachev obtained Castro's support to the formula of the freedom of choice, because Castro said, okay, but if the people chooses or exercises his right for a freedom of choice and chooses freely the socialist regime, then it's right to stick to it. And with this, they embraced.
Yes. Some of his advisors, though, had a much more negative impression of Castro. I remember Chernyayev's diaries, for instance, with regard to that particular meeting, distinctly negative in terms of their impression of Castro.
Well, I prefer that you invite Chernyayev.
We might just do that. He might improve his English. Yes, the lady in front over here. Yes, then.
Good evening, Andrei Grachev.
You have to speak into the microphone.
Good evening, Andrei Grachev. My name is Miranda Jane Campbell. I'm a British citizen. I'm a writer. Two questions. The first question I wanted to ask you, given everything you've said about the collapse of the Soviet Empire and Gorbachev's decline to be an emperor, what are your thoughts on the current situation in Russia, and especially that the special relationship between Putin, the United States, and Bush and Tony Blair? And the other thing I wanted to ask you was, when you, given that globalization is a modern form of cultural imperialism,
speak louder.
Given that globalization is a modern form of cultural imperialism, when you retire, will you expose the truth about globalization and the individuals who have been martyred in the name
thank,
of...
Thank you very much. Then the gentleman over there, please.
Commerce, industry and government. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Simon. I'm studying here at LSE, and so I come from Georgia. I have a question. From your point of view, what is the reasoning behind the Russia's imperialistic, sometimes aggressive policy towards the post-Soviet countries? I first of all mean country where I come from, Georgia, in respect of Abkhazian and South Ossetian conflicts, Moldova, and Ukraine after revolution, and maybe some other countries as well.
I'll take one more in the middle over there, the lady over there. We need the microphones. Could the stewards please be a bit more active with the microphones and move towards those I point to before they have to speak? Thank you.
My name is Daria, and I apologize if my question just slightly connected to a topic, but I wonder what's your opinion regarding Crimea gaining independent status.
You mean Crimea?
Crimea, yeah.
Yes.
Well,
you got something to sink your teeth into there.
Frankly speaking, all the questions that can hardly be related to the announced subject, though. It's not a joke, something that I'm going to tell you. But after all, Gorbachev should be considered as responsible for everything that happens after him. Just to confirm this, I shall, for example, give you the results of the two polls that were published recently in Moscow, answering a question: who is responsible for a war in Chechnya? Number one, number two person. So number one comes Gorbachev. Not Yeltsin, as you would think. And second question: who is responsible for the shooting of the Russian Parliament in 1993? As you imagine, it was two years after Gorbachev's resignation, and the order to send the tanks to shoot on the Parliament was given by Yeltsin. And again, Gorbachev came as number one. So you can see people take him as responsible for everything, because it's with him that all the trouble started for many. Well, going to the first question, now it's even not Yeltsin, it's Putin. It's Putin and Bush and Blair. What should I say? I had quite a talk today in the Chatham House on Russia's U.S. relationship, Putin and post-Putin. It's a special subject. You want me to address it in one or two sentences? I can just say that, it's natural that these leaders, on the one hand, are forced to cooperate, despite the fact that they represent different characters, different psychologies, and different political projects. Maybe repeating the formula that I used during this afternoon talk today, I can tell you that from my point of view, at a certain moment, right after the 9/11, Putin even went as far in his expression of solidarity with Bush and with Americans affected by the shock of the terrorist attack, that he offered his solidarity more or less, proposing to be Blair Beast in the East, to be a kind of a junior partner of the Americans in this anti-terrorist coalition. The development of or the evolution of a relationship between Russia and the West since that time, from my point of view, was rather unhappy. And what worries me much more than the personal relationship between Putin, Bush, and Blair is the fact that inside the Russian society now, you're having the feeling of kind of irreversible divorce with the Western societies, important Western values, including democratic values. And this is certainly the result of the way the evolution of Russia followed after the collapse of Soviet Union and resignation of Gorbachev and the cutting short of Perestroika project. But in part, from my point of view, it's also the responsibility of the West. Now, the Georgia and Russia. Well, from my point of view, it's anything you choose just the term. It's absurdity, it's stupidity, it's a fault. And again, what concerns me more is the fact that it affects millions of people, both in Russia and in Georgia, people who were brought up, who lived in generations as friends, as allies, as not only neighbors, but as members of one family. After all, one decides how he prefers to live in one state, in different states. Well, I reminded you about the role the Georgians played in Russian history. Happily, it was not limited to the presence of a Georgian at the head of the Soviet state for 30 years. But also happily, even the difficult relationship between Russia and Georgia now will not go up to the revival of the Brezhnev doctrine or the Putin doctrine, more or less, that could evoke this, let's say, sad memories.
Mm. And the Crimea, the last question.
Yeah, the Crimea, after all, the easiest way to solve the territorial disputes, actually there are two ways. Either you fight for the borders, or you behave as if they are obsolete. They don't mean anymore. So the first way was the way of empires, of quarrels, and both of empires, but also of the exploding empires. Take the case of Yugoslavia. And then there is another example of the European Union, where you travel without noticing the border, except in my case, when you travel from Paris to London.
Yes. Okay. Dr. Sked, sitting very modestly at the very back of the room up there, the first question. Then we take one more up there.
So could Could I go back to Gorbachev and his era rather than what came afterwards? I know there are lots of theories about American influence, and you've discounted these. And I've read Gorbachev's memoirs and Perestroika and what have you. The thing I find difficult to explain, and I hope you can explain it to me, therefore, is that where does the new thinking come from? How is it developed? We get told that Gorbachev's policies are the result of the new thinking, but it's always sort of just there. When does it start? How does it develop? Why does Gorbachev take it up? Is it something he's converted to, or is it something he pushes himself? I'd just like to know more about the new thinking as the sources of the perestroika and glasnost, the origins of.
A very big question, which I'm sure Andrei can shed some light. I take one more question. Gentleman in the green jumper up there. Yeah, please. No, oh, you. Great. Yeah, yeah. Do you speak?
Kind of great. Okay.
Oh, is it great? Looks green from here. Anyway, speaking through the microphone, please.
I was struck, thank you very much for the talk, but I was very struck by your comment that Gorbachev liked the idea of the EU as a model. Why the EU? Why not the US? In terms of saying, and I'm talking about the, by the way, I'm I'm German. why?
I would never have guessed.
why not go with, let's say, Abe Lincoln, draw out your enemies, and then risk a civil war, unite the country in some ways, and say the Union above everything, and whatever comes after we'll figure out. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting question. I'm really tempted to stay more than even you can afford.
We'll continue at the same time tomorrow.
The new political thinking, huge subject. To tell you frankly, I even wrote a book about it. I'm looking for a publisher. If the new political thinking. Well, it's a formula, but it came from my point of view, to try to summarize it, as a product of a certain process of evolution of Russian political elite and intellectual elite, that at the time when it could observe the obvious crisis of the communist ideology, at least the way it was applied throughout the Soviet experience, and having realized also, having lived through the unfortunate history and sterility of philosophy of confrontation that was leading nowhere, if not to the Holocaust and to the world nuclear conflict, became quite sensitive to ideas of the global world. The sources are numerous, and we know most of them. You can find them in the in the papers of the Club of Rome, you can find them in the Einstein-Russell Manifesto, you can find them in the in the reflections of representatives of intellectual elite in various countries, in Sakharov's, let's say, statements as well, and thinking. That means of those brave minds that understanding the dangerous way into which was engaged the world politics at the period of Cold War started to look for other solutions, and one important element adding to it was certainly the understanding of the uniqueness of humanity, and also the limits of the Earth from the point of view of its resources, its population, the fatality of the effect that the chaotic development of human civilization may produce on the fate of the future generation. So it's the combination of, I would say, intellectual courage, of social responsibility, well, and of a number of moral principles. So all of it combined have produced what Gorbachev and his team have presented as new political thinking, which was not just another utopian project, but from their point of view, they were convinced in it that was corresponding to the national interests of the Soviet Union at that time, that was at the well, let's say, exhausted by the arms race, and that already have fallen, as I mentioned it. It has lost already the Third World War since it took it too seriously, at least the preparation for it. And actually the Soviet Union and Soviet economy fell, from my point of view, victim to double ambition that maybe neither of which could be realized, but certainly never both together. One, the ambition of social equality to be assured by a state-run economy, and the other one, the ambition to match the its strategic adversaries, the West. That means to play the role of a superpower who would be as strong not only as the United States but as the combined potential of all of the NATO countries, plus China, by the way, at a certain moment. Yeah. Why the European Union and not the United States? Well, you know, the this philosophy of brinkmanship, pushing the situation in a, well, Dulles was suggesting it for international relations. Well, trying to apply it inside your own country would mean certainly to go to the brink of the civil war, and that would have produced a situation that you would have no guarantees that you would control. And can you imagine of a Yugoslavia with nuclear weapon?
Andre, one very last question that I wanted to ask you. In terms of your own personal memory and your friendship with President Gorbachev, we have, last week we heard from Gorbachev's biographer, Professor Archie Brown from Oxford University, and Archie's here with us today as well. And based on what Archie was telling us last week, I just wondered if I could be brave enough to ask you the question, if you were to use three terms, three adjectives to describe Gorbachev, which ones would you choose?
Well, a very American type of...
Yeah, I mean, we're getting to the talk show part of this now. It's our last lecture for the year, so we can do that.
Or a question. Well, the first three qualities that come to my mind in way, well, one after another, is loyalty to Raisa, to his friends, but also to his convictions and principles, whatever, be they popular or not. And then I would say courage. Courage in the sense of certainly intellectual courage, and in the sense of, well, daring to go where others haven't dared to go, and without being assured that you are followed and even understood during your lifetime. And then, well, you insist on three, yes?
We like threes, I think, in academic circles. It sounds so good.
Okay. The third one is the tremendous and surprising, from my point of view, nervous resource.
Yes.
Robustness. Yeah. What would you say?
Survivability, perhaps. I don't know.
Maybe he was attributing it to his peasant parents, to his peasant origin. But I remember very well that on numerous occasions, a lot of people around him, me including, were under terrible stress, were panicking, were maybe hysterical or something. Not him.
Andrei Gershov, thank you very, very much for honoring us with your presence today.